Well, good evening, everyone. Happy Friday. I'm Pam Stack, your host, and this is Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Tonight, my very special guest is James Anderson, whose debut novel, The Never Open Desert Diner, has just taken the literary world by storm. I was saying to James before the show that normally when I get advanced reader copies of books, I kind of, look them over, and then later on I read them before the show starts. This book was so fascinating, the synopsis of the book was so fascinating, that I read it immediately and consumed it in one sitting. I'm so happy that James is with me tonight. He's a busy man, but he is a short story writer. He's a poet. He is in the Pacific Northwest right now, and he's here to join me to talk about all things writing. Welcome, James Anderson, to Authors on the Air. How are you tonight, my friend?
I am terrific. It's fun to have a chance to have a conversation with you, Pam.
Thanks. In person for a change. We're always messaging each other or something like that, so I'm really glad that we're talking in person. Thank you so much for being here. Congratulations on a spectacular debut novel. It is The Never Open Desert Cafe is Diner is unlike anything I have ever read before, and apparently critics are raving about it too. I'm not the only one who's talking about it. You're garnering all kinds of praise for this book.
It's exciting, you know. I mean, I'm completely stunned, because anybody who would deign to read it said no, and there were often explicatives involved when they said no.
That's funny.
You know, I mean, somebody that I've known for, over 40 years, who is an executive in publishing, read it, and the response was, "This just sucks."
No, not really.
Yeah, really. In fact, I'll give you the.
That's not the
exact
book
quote.
That I read. Okay.
The exact quote was, "The plot is as barren as the landscape in which it should be set."
Wow. Wow.
So
that's horrible.
But
this is a wonderful story. What a character study this is. One of the finest I've read. I'm sorry that someone said that to you, but I hope you smacked him in the back of the head and say that, you know, this friendship is over. Because you obviously don't know what
absolutely
you're talking about.
Absolutely not. You know, as a matter of fact, publishing is all about taste. And
yes, it is.
And the thing is that, you know, I spent over 20 years as a publisher and an editor, I didn't say that exactly, but I rejected a lot of people. And, you know, it's funny. I was talking to a friend of mine who is the publisher and CEO of one of the major publishing companies, and he said, you know, well, I'll tell you who he is. Jonathan Galassi. He's the CEO of Farrar, Straus & Giroux. And his first novel, Jonathan's a couple years older than I am, but his first novel came out last year, Muse, which is just amazing. But, you know, the thing is that rejection is just part of it, and you know, if you let that sort of thing get you down, and I won't kid you, you know, I was getting to the point where I thought, well, gee, if it's that bad, then I ought to just move on to the next project. You know, you just have to be able to take it and move on, or, you know, just stick with it. I don't know.
When you were in publishing and editing, what type of work did you publish?
Oh, gee. I published poetry, short stories, novels. We actually pioneered what is now called creative nonfiction. So We did everything, but we were primarily focused on literature.
I want to ask you a question that you may or may not be able to answer, but were there any authors that you turned down who now are really, really, really well known?
They were all terrible and they never published.
Okay, so your taste is right then. That's good.
No. I'm sure there are, but you've got to remember, I stopped being a publisher 25 years ago.
And what have you been doing since, James, since you stopped publishing?
You are
a poet. I know you write short stories. I know you're involved in writing essays and reviews, including the Bloomsbury Review and Solstice Magazine and Northwest Review, a lot of these places. Are you still doing that? And if not, what have you been doing other than writing this beautiful novel?
Well, you know, I got married late in life, had a child, and I produced documentary films. People say, oh, wow, this is your debut novel, like I'd never written a novel. I finished my first novel when I was 16.
Wow.
And I wrote, I think, six other novels, none of which I ever tried to get published, simply because I was in publishing, and it kind of makes you jaded. Really? I mean, I figured that the world had enough writers, and what they really needed was more publishers. And I just didn't want to go down that road. And to tell you the truth, it was fear. You know, I was much better standing in the background being a cheerleader than I was taking the actual risks and going on point myself.
Interesting. Well, I think that you've hit it out of the park with this one. It's a spectacular story. The character study of Ben is just so amazing. I felt every inch of his character. I felt like I had known him for a long time, just by your meticulous writing about him and his thoughts, his mannerisms, everything. How in the world did you think about this story? How did this story come to you? Was it one you had been thinking about for a long time? Were you motivated by or inspired by seeing something, maybe driving on a trip where you saw a trucker or something? How did this story come to you?
Well, sure. Going back a lot of years, that's, you know, that landscape, that geography and the light did, in fact, totally capture me. But what happened was is that I'd been working on a novel for 4 or 5 years, and I took in a friend who was battling heroin addiction. And it's a terrible thing, but that person proceeded to steal everything from me, including my computer, with the novel on it.
Oh my.
And
that's
to
horrible.
Pawn it for drugs. And
sure.
And so I had it backed up, but that person also hacked my hard drive. And so we sort of went on the road because he was being, you know, they're trying to get him off of heroin and also trying to stay away from drug dealers to whom he owed a lot of money. And so while he was fighting heroin addiction and going through withdrawal, which is ugly, I just needed something to, you know, we're traveling around the Southwest in a bunch of CD hotels and whatnot. And, and I needed something to read. And years ago, Robert Parker, who, you know, bless his heart, I miss so much, but Bob Parker told me that the reason he started writing the Spencer novels was because he had read the Raymond Chandler novels over and over and over again, and he just wanted something new to read. So, yeah, I mean, and so that was, I was telling myself a story to keep myself entertained, and that's it.
Sorry,
you there?
Cat. Yes, that was my cat meowing at me for dinner. I'm sorry. Usually they don't say anything, but she just came up and meowed right in the microphone. I'm sorry, James. How embarrassing.
Mm. No, not at all. Everybody's a critic.
I'm telling you, she weighs about 5 pounds, and she just looked at me and decided to meow. I'm so sorry. Right in the, Polly, that was so rude. Stay in the other room. Oh, my God. So you wrote your own story. You had to have seen this landscape to describe it so well. But I have to tell you, it's so desolate. I felt horrible for the people who lived in this place and for your character, Ben, because I thought, geez, you know, what a horrible life to be on this desolate road going from the same place to the same place, never seeing anything new. And it was depressing to me at first. And then I had to get in to the story itself to see the beauty in what you were writing. And it really was truly wonderful. I liked all your characters. I immediately saw, and tell me if I'm wrong of the way I'm reading this, but when Ben's guy tells him, oh, there's somebody from a movie studio here that wants to look around, just drive with you on the road, I got the...
A reality show producer, yeah.
Yeah, that... And something that the guy said on their first or second day out sent all the hairs on the back of my neck standing up straight. I thought, things are not what they seem. And I guess, for me, that was when the whole story turned.
Huh.
Did I get it?
Oh, well, yes. I mean, you did. And but, you know, this whole thing... I mean, I was raised in Oregon. I was born in Seattle. I was raised in Oregon. I worked as a logger and a commercial fisherman and did a lot of jobs. People say, well, how come you happen to write about the desert? And that's because in that landscape that you find so desolate, what really matters rises above the din of life. You know, it's the connections between people, because
yes,
as you go along on the road with Ben, what you think are disparate
yes,
characters, you find out that they're all linked by this land and this place that
yes,
they've chosen to live, and that in a way Ben is that conduit that connects them. But you have a chance to be involved in an incredible natural landscape and the light, and what's for me just the pure magic of that kind of existence and that kind of landscape. My friend Bruce Berger, who writes of the desert, who's a fantastic nonfiction writer, says that his books focus on that intersection between landscape and humanity. And I think that that's kind of what I do in a fictional way.
Yeah, it is a perfect description, I think. It's an amazing thing. Are you happy with how the book turned out? Or have you gone back and looked at it and said, oh, I wish I would have done this?
You know, I really haven't had time, but The book was originally published by a small to medium-sized publisher. That publisher, that my original publisher, Jack Estes, said in a NPR interview that he published my book. He liked my book for all the reasons everybody else hated it. And So anyhow, what happened was is that the response was so amazing to the book that Crown Publishing, which is a division of Random House, picked it up,
right.
And it was just re-released in a slightly revised edition. So I had a chance to go back and make some changes. I mean, I have to say, I've always been a champion of small publishers, and I still am. But Random House, Crown, my editor, and so on, everybody has been just so terrific. And they pointed out a few things, like this copy editor at Random House, Cindy Berman. I've never met her, never spoken to her. But she, little things, because, you know, the novel took 6 months to write, but it took 2 years and 14 major revisions before that first came out. And,
right.
But anyway, and so, you know, you have a lot of people kind of running naked and barefoot through your stuff. And, you know, plus you change things. And novels are organic. If you change something on page 23, it's going to change something on page, you know, 41 and 192. And
exactly.
So anyhow, Cindy Berman just discreetly, politely, you know, in the margins, in the track changes or so, our comments, says,
right.
I don't know how things are in the desert, but she said, it seems to me you have a full moon for 3 weeks. you know, so there were. There were some little things in that.
That's a really good editor.
And Nate Robertson, you know, everybody at Crown is under the age of 30.
That's scary, isn't it? But they're
so passionate, and they're so good at their jobs, and they care. And they care so much, and I've been blown away.
Yeah, all to your benefit, and by the way, to the reader's benefit as well. I have to say, it is an exceptional book. Are you working on the follow-up?
I just started to chew ice, which is not a thing to do in the middle of an interview. So anyway, the answer to that is yes.
Now, will this be a completely different book?
No, because what I did is when my agent, David Hale Smith, said, okay, Crown is interested and they want to, you know, republish and reintroduce, because for a smaller publisher, that first edition was kind of hard to find, you know, and he said they want to do another book, another with Ben Jones. And I'd kind of thought about that, but what I did was I went back to Nate and David and so on, and I said, I don't want to write one character for the rest of my life. You know, I don't want to do that. I've got too many other things. But I had this idea of making it, I prefer to call it a triptych, but basically a trilogy. And so the way we're envisioning it now is there will be three books, of which The Never Open Desert Diner is the first. And then the new one is called tentatively Lullaby Road. But these three books will follow a story arc that begins with Claire and the cello.
Interesting. Very interesting characters that you've developed here, I have to say. I want to take a moment to remind everyone I am speaking with the magnificent James Anderson. His book is called The Never Open Desert Diner. It is, first of all, has an exceptional cover on it. If you could go on my website and look, or on my Facebook page, or on the book review page, or go on my Twitter page or Pinterest, and you'll see it. It is just a really beautiful jacket. It's just gorgeous. And I actually have two copies that I'm willing to go ahead and give away to callers who can call with a really good question for James. The number is 347-633-9609. These are, one book is an advanced reader copy, and the other is the hardcover. So give me a call if you're interested in winning a book. All you have to do is just ask a question. 347-633-9609. James, tell me what your process is like. You've been writing for a really long time, and you've done a lot of interesting things in your life, and you've written poetry and short stories and essays and so on, and reviewed and contribute to magazines and other literary pursuits. Are you a very disciplined author, a writer? Do you go to work at 9 and get home at 4 or something like that? What is your process like? You know, go to an office and, I mean, treat it like a real job. Or, it took you quite a few months to write it, but I know that there's a lot of stuff that goes in between the just sitting down to write it part, but the actual writing part.
You know, I'm usually up about 4 in the morning, between 4 and 5. And, you know, before the fires of the day reach your butt. And I love the early morning. And so I just, I try to write then. But I wouldn't say I'm terribly disciplined. I've found that once I enter that world, there's a fine novelist, a friend, and she was also one of my mentors, Sandra Schofield. And Sandra said one time that you're always writing, and you may not actually be putting the pen down, which of course you have to do, or you know, whatever it is. But what I found is that I'm kind of like a method writer. In the first draft, which is the most fun, because for me, the draft is the outline, you know.
Sure.
I have no damn idea what's going to happen. This is just pure fun for me. But as a method writer, I just sort of close my eyes and all of my senses go to work, and I kind of report what I see and what I hear, and so
I love that you engage all the senses. You can smell the desert and smell the truck fumes and everything else, and know everything that's going on around you when you are method writing like that, I would imagine.
Well, you know, and then you write the rough draft, and so you have the basic story, and then over a series of revisions, you have a sense of what the story is and who the characters are. And so then you kind of go to work doing the embroidery, and you go, I really like that, but I need to find another way to say it, or a better way to say it. And then you just work at that. So I am not terribly disciplined, and I don't feel like I really need to be, because if I'm engaged, I'm having fun. And the number one thing for me when I'm writing is to have fun, to enjoy what I'm doing. And I, you know, I turned 64 last week, and I have to tell you, I'm sort of into having fun, and if it's not fun, I got to make it fun.
There you go. So, that makes sense to me. Your use of the language and vocabulary is exceptional. I like books that don't talk down to me as a reader. you give me enough information in your narrative and dialogue for me to know what's going on, but you leave it up to me to figure it out as a reader. And that's really important. I can form my own picture of what the character looks like and what the landscape is. And I like that. Even though you're very vivid in some of your descriptions, I can picture it. I would venture to say our images of what this landscape looked like are very different. And that's probably pretty much fun, the fun of it all, you know, allowing the reader to create a lot of it themselves.
You know, maybe, but I really feel as if the reader is a character in the book. The reader brings their life and their experiences and their thoughts and their feelings. And if you do all the work, then there's no room for the reader. I want the reader to feel proprietary and be a participant in the story. I've had the pleasure of meeting him a couple times, but one of my favorite novelists and a wonderful teacher, Andre Dubas, who wrote House of Sand and Fog and Townie and so on. And Andre said in an interview, I think in Atlantic, that he begins every writing session by reading poetry. I believe that's the great fun to offer a sense of musicality to the language and a depth of metaphor to begin to think about the world as represented by language. So poetry and the fact that, you know, gee, my circle of friends includes so many fine poets. That's really been a help to me.
I'm glad that you said that, because I think that is probably why your use of the language is so rich. James W. Hall is one of my favorite authors ever, and he was a poet.
One of my favorites. Jim Hall is amazing. I love him.
He's terrific, and I love the man dearly. He was a poet, and sometimes I have to read everything out loud because it sounds so beautiful to my ear. It's a different way to experience a book. And I like to know that authors occasionally do read their own dialogue and some of their narratives, so they know what it sounds like. I think you get a different sense of it when you hear it. When you hear it.
No, it's true.
When you read it.
I read everything out loud over and over, and I try it. You know, I'm friends with actors, and I have just amazing respect for actors, and sometimes, you know, just asking them. I have friends who are playwrights as well, and when I say, okay, I have a little problem with this dialogue. Quick here, right? They can read that same kind of dialogue 50 different ways.
Different ways, yes.
And so all of a sudden it opens up and you go, I never heard it that way before. Well, that's not what I meant. Or all of those things. And again, you know, that's the influence of poetry. A number of people who write great prose are also amazing poets. Luis Urrea is incredible, and so is Sherman Alexie. They bring that quality, and I think that, you know, and it's not this sort of, you know, weirdness, you know, I mean, that sometimes people who don't read poetry, don't know anything about it, think that it's a feat and it's you know, I don't know, that it's not comprehensible.
Storytelling in another form, though, isn't it? It's storytelling in another form. I mean, it truly is. But I have to say, as a reader, I always appreciate that someone is a poet first, because and by the way, you know, we're in National Poetry Month, just in case, so everybody knows. The fact is that I think I like how the words come out of my mouth when I'm reading someone's work who I know is a poet, whether they're writing, this is a very noir, stylish type of a book that you've created here. And I like how the sound of it. I like how it sounds when I read some of your narrative. So congratulations on that. I think you nailed
it.
Well,
I just listened to the first part of the audiobook.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy, Haywood, somebody who does it, really, I think, did a fine job catching it. You know, this book is going into foreign editions,
right.
You know, French and Japanese and whatever. So I wonder how that's going to be translated. But, you know, the thing is that you start paying. Noam Chomsky has this, it stayed with me for years, but what he said is, language is the landscape of a mind.
Yes.
And I have always loved that, because how you say something, and you know, the tone and all of that gives you a picture of the speaker. And so I think you really need to do that.
The timbre and all. Yes, I agree with you. And I'm surprised that dialogue-laden books, and that does not make them wrong, just there are books that are very dialogue-driven versus the narrative that goes on, that those authors don't read out loud. And you know, I think you can tell sometimes. I think you can tell. Language, especially if you're writing the opposite sex, I think you have to be very careful. Correct me if I'm wrong here. Because
you're right.
There are some things that I read sometimes and I say, no woman I know would ever say that. And so those, I think when you're writing opposing dialogues like that, not so much a man speaking to another man, but if you're having a man and a woman with a conversation, and I don't mean someone in the same profession like police work or something like that, to have a normal conversation, the dialogue has to be real. And how do you know unless you're speaking it? Does that make sense?
Well, nobody I've ever known knew more about literature. In fact, I have to say that Bob Parker, whenever I left Bob Parker's company, I had cramps in my cheeks from laughing so hard. And the same thing with our recently departed friend, Jim Harrison, who, to tell you the truth, that Jim's death has really hit me pretty hard. But, you know, the thing is about the writing. I mean, even in dialogue, especially, there are so many different ways to say things. And in really good dialogue, people don't say exactly what they mean. There's none of this he said, she said kind of thing going on. And what you want to do, I think, and what I work very hard at doing, is there's sort of a subtle question about why did that person choose to say that at this particular moment in that way?
Yes.
Not so much what they're saying, but what's behind it. And Bob Parker, I mean, you kind of love Bob Parker, you know, because his books were dialogue driven. They were voice driven. And in a way, so is mine. But Bob wrote this, I mean, one of the many great, you know, Parker lines, but a woman, confronts him. He's sort of pretending to be somebody else to get information. And she says to him, you know, Mr. Spencer, are you here under false pretenses? And he says, of course I am. What other kind are there? And which is pure Bob Parker. It's like, oh, great. But you know, I've read so many people. I read all the time, and I read physics, and I read I read numbers theory. I read creative nonfiction. I read you know the essays of Terry Tempest Williams and Barry Lopez and Craig Childs, and it's just, as well as novels and poetry and all kinds of stuff. And you just take everything and it goes into a great big pot and you heat it up and you throw in some of your own potatoes and stir it all up. And what comes out is something like the Never Open Desert Diner.
It's really true. Your dialogue between Claire and Ben, especially in the beginning, is very interesting to me. It's very interesting to me. It's it paints her as, I don't want to say ethereal, but I know that I got the impression that she could have easily been a mirage to Ben and to me as I was reading it. It was really interesting.
You know, it's so interesting because I never thought of that, Pam, and yet Colin McCann, wonderful writer, Let the Great World Spin and Transatlantic. He won the National Book Award a few years ago. Colin said the same thing. He said, this book works on mirages. Things are, you're not quite sure whether they're there. You're not sure what's real or not. And so that whole thing with Claire, you have to realize that the undercurrent of this book is that Ben is 38 years old. He's an orphan. As far as he knows, his father is Native American and his mother was a Jewish social worker, but he was abandoned on the Warm Springs Reservation in Oregon. And he wants to belong. He wants to have a wife and a family. But, you know, his whole life is spent out in the desert with all these whack jobs.
Which brings up another character, and that is our dear father with the cross and how they share the imaginary cigarette. Again, the use of is it really there? How are they really doing this? And I'm trying to visualize this whole scene with the shared invisible cigarette. And you do little things like that through the book with the twins and everything else that I find so fascinating. It's almost sleight of hand, and you have to really pay attention or else you're going to miss something. And so I have to tell you that before I knew you, when you were coming on the show, I had to go through the book again and kind of do a real fast skim through it just to be sure that that's what I really read. It was a masterful thing you did and something I very rarely see. I'm like you. I read a lot. I don't read as diverse as you do. I know nothing about math or quantum physics or string theory or any of those other things. However, I do read about 400 books a year, and I read cross-genre. So I don't recall seeing this type of storytelling where I had to shake my head and say, wait a minute, did I really read that? You know, it was really fascinating. It's fascinating. You had all these little things in there, and it was just like this compendium of oddities and odd people in this one little space. I loved it. It was brilliant.
And yet those people, as I've heard, are very real. I know that I did a television interview last year, and the woman that was, she said, I love these characters, but she said, I love to read about them. She said, I really don't ever want to meet them in person. She said, I'll read about them, but the idea of meeting these people scares the hell out of me.
it's kind of like one of those gypsy traveling circuses that comes through town every once in a while. You don't mind going and looking at all the oddities, but you don't really want to be friendly with them all. I understand that. I understand her inclination to say that because they seem so far removed from what we consider normal, yet that is their normal. And that is their normal. That is the way they made a choice to live, and they're very happy in their choices to live that way. So it's a very interesting dichotomy there.
Well, normal is one of those things that, you know, I think
very
that
subjective,
in their,
I know. Yeah.
Yeah, they're really in their world. I mean, Ben's sort of in and out of their world a little bit, and so. He's the one. One of Ben's best qualities is he just accepts people the way they are. And one of the sort of choruses in the book where, you know, something strange will happen or whatever, and he'll go, well, that's a mystery. And like most mysteries, I'm just going to leave it alone. But of course, when it comes
to Claire, down to it, right.
Yeah.
He wants to unravel that mystery for sure. You know, and I'm thinking about it. You did that little sleight of hand thing again when we were talking about somebody saying, oh, I saw him dancing in the diner with a woman. And Ben was taken aback, and he said, it can't be because she's gone. You know, it was just an interesting book. It was an interesting book on several different levels, James. I have to tell you.
I have to tell you that whole thing with cigarettes. Sometimes, I mean, I'm a sort of, it's not adversarial, but when somebody tells me I can't do something, it's like the only thing in the world I can think of doing. Is doing it. And a great poet and fiction writer, a friend of mine for years and years is a man named Steve Huff. And I was in one of Steve's classes and he was talking about writing dialogue. And he was talking about you don't have cigarettes anymore because people just don't smoke. But in fiction, especially, you know, if you look at the fiction of the 20s and 30s, 40s, 50s,
sure.
and so on.
Pulp and noir and all those. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, and people were smoking and it became a convention, how they smoked, how the smoke came out, flicking the ashes off the cigarette, all of that kind of stuff. He said, you don't really have that as punctuation, for writing dialogue anymore. And so when I was writing the book, I was thinking, oh yeah, I'm going
to,
yeah. So what I did
is an unusual way to do it though.
So the thing is that both Preacher John, the guy that pulls the cross through the desert, and Ben have both quit smoking, but they miss it. And so they start this little charade between the two of them where they share an imaginary cigarette. They roll
so
it.
Strange. Yes.
The smell of the sulfur match, the whole thing. And so I basically got to use a cigarette in dialogue that is not a cigarette.
I know. It was just that, you know, when I'm reading this, I'm thinking, okay, I can't wait to tell James what a nut job he is. This is very strange. But then you had all these little, maybe these are things that people told you you couldn't do. I don't know. But I couldn't wait to read what else you had come up with. And you had all these little twists and, you know, the bra and the sports car and the, you know, the workout pants and all that kind of, and then, you know, the reality show people and all that other kind of, it's just so, really, it was a gypsy circus for me in the beginning. I loved it. It was just marvelous. It was really well done. Very fun.
Well,
I can't wait. What is your target date for the next book?
Well, it depends on whether I'm telling the truth or not.
Well, there you go.
You know, it's well along. I should be delivering the rough draft next month. And then sometime next spring, I guess, maybe. I don't really know.
Let me ask you a question. Are you having fun doing this?
Hell yeah.
There you go.
I have, and And for me, when you're writing, you know, if the one thing you tell yourself, I mean, if you're going through all this angst and, you know, and so on,
right.
Dennis Lehane, who I dearly love because he's such a pragmatic blue collar Boston guy. And he says, well, you know,
who was schooled by left-handed Gordon James Hall, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that whole group and Sterling Watson and Carl Hyacin.
Out of FIU in FIU North in my hometown in Miami. I know.
I mean, that's why when you posted on Facebook that you were going to this thing with all these Florida writers, I'm going, oh, my God, you lucky person. But, you know, my point is what Dennis said. He said, you know, something like, if all else fails, just tell the damn story.
Yeah, it's really true.
And,
really,
you know, because
true.
You
that's
can
you
can go back and hammer and chisel it and embroider it or whatever. I'm mixing every metaphor I can think of here. But and just do it. But and sometimes I'll just write. In parentheses, when I'm doing a rough draft, this needs to happen, right? Or something needs to happen here. Or
you just want to say, tell the damn story and don't worry about it. Just tell the damn story and let it happen. Sometimes that's
forward,
the best way. That's, yeah.
Forward movement. You've got to have you've got to have forward movement at some level, and sometimes you know what you want to say and it just flows, and other times all you can say is something needs to happen here. Or you know what's going to happen, you know, you just say in a simple declarative sentence, this is what happens, and then you write it later.
Fun. I tell you, I have so enjoyed talking to you tonight. I wish we had more time. I'd be talking your ear off. I want to remind everyone, next week I have Lee Fisher-Hellman is on Monday. On Tuesday, we are off, believe it or not. Wednesday, Steve Loudon and Alex Cabrera, whose book is getting all kinds of great reviews, is going to be here. And then Will Vajero on Friday. It is going to be a Noir on the Radio week. And then I am on book tour with Libby Fisher-Hellman here in Southwest Florida. And we return to regular programming end of April. In the meantime, I have been talking to the delightful James Anderson, whose new book, The Never Open Desert Diner, is wonderful. I wholeheartedly recommend it. And if you have not sat through this already, if you want to send me a PM tomorrow on my Facebook page, first one to send me a PM is going to get a book. James, will you come back sometime and just talk to me more?
I will. And, you know, I love Will's work. I'm going to be listening to that interview.
And you'll want to listen to Alex Segura and to Steve Loudon, too. Steve's book is Crosswire, and it's excellent. And Alex is actually on book tour. He'll be down in at Murder by the Beach also here in Florida. So you're going to want to listen to them, too. They're really good. And, of course, Libby Fisher-Hellman, who's not only a fantastic award-winning author, she's one of the hosts in the network, and she's a dear friend. I get the opportunity to take her around on book tour here. So it's going to be a ton of fun. We're going all over.
Well, will you do me one favor? When you see Les Stanford, will you give him a big hug for me?
I will, and I haven't seen him in ages, but I, you know, when I go over there, usually for Miami Book Fair, that's the best time to catch him. He's there. He, you know, he's been writing a lot of nonfiction, too. He's
He does it all.
You know, and he and Jim Hall are formidable teachers. A lot of great authors have come out of there, like Lehane, Joe Clifford, and more people, you know, who are terrific. So I thank you.
Do you have, like, the best job ever? I mean,
I do. I have to tell you, James, that I'm in my fourth year of doing this. And when I say I have to go to work, I almost have to bite my tongue because I want to say I get to go to play. I get 50 books a week come across my desk, so I get to pick and choose the best of the best. I read about 400, and I've interviewed almost 2,000 authors now, not counting the other shows on the network. I am the luckiest person in the world. I talk to just the most interesting people. I don't own a television, so you guys have to understand, writers are my celebrities. I'm a big fan girl. Always have been.
But do you think about how lucky we are to get to talk to somebody who reads that much and that cares that much about books? I mean, it's a win-win.
I think. It's a lovely symbiotic relationship, isn't it? I want authors to come on here. I don't care what genre they write in. I don't care if they're traditionally published or if they're self-published, if they've got 50 books or they're just coming out with one. I want to talk to everyone. I think everyone deserves a chance to be heard. I keep creating shows in the network for them. You know, I'm the executive producer of this network. I created Nora on the Radio for that reason. I'll create as many shows as people want to hear. So,
you just keep on, and if you ever
thank
want
you.
Me back, it'd be a pleasure. And meanwhile,
why don't you come back and do an interview with someone? Why don't you let me get in touch with Les Standiford and you do an interview with him?
Sure. I'd love to,
okay.
But you know, some of my favorite Les Standiford books are not the one that he did on the Florida Railway is one of my favorites.
You can talk to him about anything you want. I'll be your production assistant. I won't even talk. I'll let you do all the talking. You can invite anybody you want. Okay.
No, you're an angel, Pam. It's been so much fun. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with me tonight. I hope you have a terrific, wonderful weekend. I hope it's creative in whatever it is you want to do. Or if you just want to sit around and do nothing, I hope that's fun too.
It will be. Thank you so much, Pam.
Thank you so much. Have a good evening, James, and I'll talk to you again soon. Good night.
Thank you. Good night.
And that's it, our show for tonight. This is a trademark copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Stay tuned next week. Have a beautiful weekend, everyone. And thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.